Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmers.
Hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks the title of today's episode.
Healthy Conflict, Happy Couple, an interview with Lisa Gray.
And we just finished that interview, and she was delightful. It was
really
nice. And you know, it's one of those things, of course, I'm always looking for this anyway, but there were so many overlaps with the way she conceptualizes her work and the way I like to think about stuff.
Exactly.
So it's like, oh, I kept noticing all these,
yeah,
you know, interesting...
Yeah, all the simpatico stuff there going on with the two of you.
Yeah. She's doing really interesting work. And through her own experience, and you'll see when you do the interview, she used to be an air traffic controller. I mean, wow, what a crucible to come out of.
Right.
And then become a couples therapist, you know. Well. It's really cool. So
she's used to stress and conflict.
And astonishingly, she seems like a really nice person.
She does, you know? And very calm.
Yes, right. So anyway, I hope you'll enjoy that interview. We certainly enjoyed it. But before we go there, let's talk about some of the stuff we've been doing and stuff that we'd like you to know about.
All right.
Starting with,
it's not about communication. Why everything you know about couples therapy is wrong.
Now, that's the most recent of my two big books on the subject.
Yes.
And that is available anywhere books are sold, and also available as an audiobook where I did the narration for that. And that actually dovetails nicely with what we talked about. Mm-hmm. It came up in our conversation. You'll see that
yes,
when you watch the or hear the interview.
Yes, we won't spoil it.
We won't spoil it, yes. And also the book that started this whole podcast, really.
Right. Reigniting the Spark. Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
Also available anywhere books are sold in all of the various formats you would like.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sign up for my newsletter, which I've been doing just about once a month, it's not, you know, on a fixed schedule, but if you do that, we will give you a reward. This sounds like a public radio fundraiser.
Yes,
we're not even raising funds here,
no.
Folks, but we'll give you a reward, and
yes.
You'll have to buy the tote bag. We'll talk about the tote bags in a minute. But this is the reward you will get, actually not the book that Judy is holding for those of you watching it, but it is,
yes.
She's got the right book there, but not that book itself,
yeah,
but
yeah.
The PDF of that
PDF
book.
Of this
we're not book. Giving away, I'm not spending money on you folks. Cheap that I am. But, well, if you sign up for my newsletter, Dr.
Yes,
Chalmers'
you get a
newsletter.
Free PDF of 7 words to jumpstart your love life.
Which is a nice little sort
booklet.
Of compact compendium
yes.
of all the ideas that I have that relate to jumpstarting your love life, which is a thing that a lot of people want to do. And
mm-hmm.
so you've got some tips in there.
That's right. And you were talking about tote bags and giveaways.
Yes,
we've got merch. Those away, but we do have.
We have.
Our merch. Our Couples Therapy in 7 Words merch. We have these beautiful mugs in the 11 and 15 ounce sizes with our logo on one side and our motto, be kind, don't panic, and have faith, on the other side.
Just what you need for your favorite
lovely
beverages.
Lovely red, white, and black colors.
Yes.
For those of you who are listening.
And the tote bag that Judy
bags.
Mentioned. A beautiful tote bag that has the same logo on one side
right.
and motto on the other. And we use it all the time, our
all
tote bags.
All the time.
We're toting them around a lot. If you ever see somebody carrying those tote bags, it's probably us. But if you buy them, by golly, that could be you too. So let's put in a word for our sponsor.
Okay, our sponsor, The Blue Tent. Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
And the sales for that have been actually ticking up quite nicely, mm-hmm. especially since it got written up. I mean, it was an ad, but it got written up in Hadassah Magazine.
Right, in their book section.
In their book section. Mm-hmm. And we happen to be recording this on the first day of Hanukkah.
Yes.
And the Blue Tent makes a great Hanukkah gift. It makes a great Christmas gift.
Yes,
it makes a great gift for Kwanzaa. It even makes a great gift for Festivus. So that you can air your grievances and have erotic tales at the same time.
There you go.
For people who are into that kind of sex. You know, that's kinky stuff right there. So for any of your favorite holidays, the Blue Tent makes an ideal gift. And we
absolutely.
Hope you will go there. And you should go to Laria Zilber, LariaZylber, LariaZylber.com. And you'll have all the information there as to how to acquire those books. Or just search for it on
right.
Amazon.
And it's available in paperback. And Kindle and audio version, and I do the audio.
Yep.
Narration.
And I will also note, we would like you to let folks know about our podcast by reviewing us and rating us and doing all that kind of stuff, and just tell folks about it on your favorite social media.
That's right. You're our best advertisements.
Absolutely. And so, without further ado, we'll get into our interview with Lisa Gray, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Lisa Gray. Lisa is a couples therapist in private practice in the San Francisco Bay Area, specializing in high conflict couples and chronic illness and pain. After working as an air traffic controller for 10 years and serving as a peer debriefing counselor for fellow controllers, Lisa decided to go back to school to study counseling. She graduated from John F. Kennedy University in 2004 with a master's degree in clinical counseling and has been working in the field ever since. Lisa is passionate about teaching couples to practice healthy conflict so that their relationships can thrive and grow. Lisa reviews self-help books on her Instagram, Therapy Book Nook. She lives in the Bay Area with her family and three large dogs. Lisa, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you.
Wow, air traffic controller.
Yeah, I joke that I used to have a job where everyone did what I say, and now I have a job where no one does what I say.
That, I hadn't thought of it that way. I was thinking more like, you used to have a job where people were in constant stress, and now you just work with couples who are in the midst of, you know, difficulties.
Yeah, it's very similar, actually, yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, we always like to start off by asking our guests, how did you get into this work? And of course, your intro said some of that, but you know, tell us something about your own journey into what you do.
Yeah, so I did the peer debriefing for air traffic. And if people are familiar with the critical incident stress debriefing model, what they do is team a peer debriefer up with a mental health professional. So I was kind of the one who spoke the air traffic language, and then they'd pair me up with a mental health professional. And I always loved talking to the mental health professionals, and I loved the process of doing the critical incident stress debriefings. And then I had kids. And two air traffic controllers raising kids doesn't work very well because there's midnight shifts and, you know, just general shift work. So I decided to stay home, and I hated doing that. So I was not a cut out to be a stay-at-home mom. So my husband just said, you know, you liked that counseling stuff. Why don't you go back to school and do that? So I did. Yeah.
Perfect. Wow. Yeah, that's neat.
So the two of you were air traffic controllers.
Yeah. Yes.
I had this image when you said that of your kids as blips on a screen that you were just keeping track of, you know.
Yes, yes. It was kind of like that at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you focus on is conflict, which is fascinating. And you describe it as a skill. And I'm, of course, in doing couples therapy, I'm often recognizing that that's an important skill to have. Please tell us about that. How did you come into that way of thinking of things?
Well, you know, so often people are telling me I'm just not good at conflict, like as if they think that it's a temperament or a character trait, or maybe you're just born with it. I don't know. But really, it is just a skill like any other skill. It's just that we don't get any training on how to develop that skill. Like there's no class in high school. There's no formal education on conflict management. There's just kind of what you saw your parents doing, maybe, or your caregivers doing, whether that was healthy or not healthy. And then your own experiences having conflict with other people and just kind of winging it and seeing if that worked or didn't work. So we just kind of fall into these patterns. So I think that people then get the impression that they're not good at conflict, but actually you develop the conflict just like you develop every other, you know, you develop the skill just like you develop every other skill, which is obtaining the information and then practice, practice, practice.
Yeah. It's interesting when in my books, couples therapy in 7 words, our 7 words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
Yeah.
And to have faith, I describe faith as I describe it. It's not like religion or a particular set of beliefs. It is actually a skill that you have to practice. And it's a mindset that you learn to practice.
Yeah.
And I can imagine it. Oh, well, I like to think, because it's my favorite, you know, it's my favorite way of thinking, that it overlaps a lot with how you would practice conflict and not freak out completely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, you know, how do you do that? You know, how do you help people do that?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to do is convince people that practicing conflict is something that they want to do, you know, because we don't have the education, and because conflict has been so painful for so many people, that's the last thing that they want to hear is that I should do that more. I should practice that more, you know? So I think, like, first you have to kind of help them with the attitudes and the mindsets that would help them to understand how conflict really works. You also have to teach them how to manage their body, how to manage their bodily reaction, because physiological reactions get in the way so often of having good conflict. So there's kind of some foundational pieces that happen first before you start kind of getting into, okay, and then here's how you practice the conflict, you know?
So how does conflict work?
Well, so I wrote a book called Healthy Conflict, Happy Couple. And I have this three-step process that I do in the book. So the first step is a setup. So I feel like most conflict happens when you're already mad, which is a very bad idea. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, the only time couples are ever talking about what their issues are is when they're already in a fight about it. And so the first step is I'm trying to get them to set up conflict conversations in advance. You know, most couples, they know what their conflicts are. I mean, I ask any couple, they can tell me what it is that they argue about, you know, mm-hmm. it's finances or it's the in-laws or whatever. And so what I want them to do is to say something like, hey, I'd love to talk about our recent issues that we've had with finances. What would be a good time for you? And to have the other person say, how about tomorrow night after dinner? And then no one's ambushing anyone. They both know they're going to have this conversation. They both know what the topic is. They can have some time to think about what they want to say about that topic. And that's the first step. And I think it's really crucial because.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. You know, because a lot of times I think when you say conflict to folks, they assume you mean when they're mad.
Yes.
That if they're not mad, it's not a conflict.
Yeah.
And what you're pointing out is certainly, no, there's all kinds of differences
uh-huh.
that go up to the level of conflict in the sense of that where they're significant. It's like, wow, we better work this out because it's causing an issue if we don't work it out.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be mad to do that.
Right. And you'll get this argument. Why would I want to have a conflict conversation like on a perfectly good Saturday morning when I'm not already mad? You know, why would I ever want to do that? And I just sort of say, it's kind of like credit cards. Like you can pay now or you can pay later, but you're going to pay, you know? So like, it's not like if you don't have this conversation on Saturday morning, you're never going to have to go through that. You are, you're just going to do it when you're mad and it's not going to be productive.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a great distinction, you know, that you can have the notion of conflict that doesn't immediately mean being mad. And actually, there's another distinction that occurs to me that I sometimes have made, not a whole lot with couples. Occasionally it comes up. It was more like when I used to work with adolescents, mm-hmm. this would come up because they wouldn't necessarily recognize this. You do realize you can be mad without being horrible.
Right.
There's
that
distinction as well. You can be mad and still respectful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And anger. Yeah. And anger is one of those emotions that I feel like people feel like they have to behave according to the feeling if they have it. You know, not all feelings are like that, but anger seems to be like that. Like if I feel angry, I have to act angry. And that's just not true. Yeah.
And I guess a lot of sex therapists that have also brought up the same thing, that if you're having problems with sex, you don't want to wait till you're in the bed to talk about it. You want to find a neutral place to talk about
Absolutely.
It. Absolutely. You don't, you know, you're
right. Yeah, that would fall in the same thing that, you know, I would just consider that another conflict that a couple might have that they would use my model to talk about. And they would start by setting up the conversation. And then I have a two-step conversation that happens. So I find that couples, when they then sit down to have the conflict conversation, most of my couples move way too fast into problem solving. They're trying to solve the problem before they even understand each other, you know? So I make my couples split those into two completely separate conversations to avoid the temptation.
It's so interesting.
So the first conversation is just to understand each other. Uh-huh. So no problem solving allowed, no brainstorming allowed, nothing like that. The first conversation is just that speaker listener model where it's like, I tell you how I'm feeling. You read back to me what I said, not what you think about what I said, but what I said, until I know that you understand me and you can say something validating if it's true. And then we switch places. You tell me exactly how you feel. I read it back, ask questions, read it back until I know that I understand how you're feeling about the topic, validate you if I can, and then we stop. We stop the conversation.
I have so often said to couples, don't leap to solving the problem too quickly, because they're not crazy. They want to do that because it reduces anxiety.
Right. Yes.
The trouble is if they're apt to skip over the actual differences. It's one Absolutely. Of my slogans is get to the right argument.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Times when they start, they don't know what the right argument is.
No.
That can be very scary, actually, to get to the right argument, or it can be a relief. It's like, that's what we're worried about. Oh, no problem. Or, right. oh boy, that's what we're worried about. We're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I talk about is what I call the oh shit moment. The oh shit moment. It's not I just hit my thumb with a hammer. It's, oh shit, no wonder we're having this problem. Mm-hmm. Now I understand what your issue is, and I understand why I have a problem with it. At least we know where we're coming from here.
Right. And that's such a great point, because if you don't get to that oh shit moment, then you're trying to solve a problem, and really all you have is two options for solution. You have like my solution and your solution, right? But once you get to that moment, there's so many other solutions that open up, because now I get what you're saying.
Yes.
I get what your problem really is. And I wouldn't have come up with a solution that addressed that until I actually know what that is, right?
Yeah. And that's, when you have an intimate conversation, which is what I would define that as, mm-hmm. two people not freaking out, tolerating the anxiety. That's in our podcast, I've suggested a drinking game. And whenever I say tolerate the anxiety, if somebody takes a drink, they'll be drunk by the end of the podcast.
yes, exactly.
But anything, if they tolerate the anxiety of intimacy in that way, mm-hmm. take a shot. Take a shot. Yeah. Uh-huh. If they tolerate the anxiety of intimacy that way, then they actually form a joint mind. They're, uh-huh. they're each going to think of things neither one of them would have thought of by themselves. And that's what growth is. That's uh-huh. how it happens. And not to sugarcoat, because also sometimes that means, oh my God, we may not be compatible with each other, which is
right.
a possibility. But if mm-hmm. you don't face that, then you're not going to get anywhere. And usually that turns out, no, they're fine. They just need mm-hmm. to understand each other better.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like tolerating the anxiety is kind of a skill too. Like you might have to build up to it, and that's kind of where managing your body comes in. It's like, if you feel yourself getting flooded by that feeling, it's okay to take a break under certain, parameters, of course. But, learning how to like manage your own body in that moment too is very important. Otherwise you're going to not be able to follow the model because you're too flooded to do it.
You know, the Gottman's trick of having people wear pulse oximeters.
Yeah.
And actually I had never met, and not that I've interviewed that many people specifically trained in Gottman, but a few weeks ago we interviewed Heidi Sauter, I think uh-huh. is who it was. Yeah, yeah. And she's a Gottman trained person. And she actually does that with folks. She actually has them, put on pulse oximeters. And when the pulse rate exceeds, I think it's 100 for regular people and 80 for uh-huh. Athletes, okay, you're getting flooded. Take a break. Because
right.
there's no point, a lot of your mm-hmm. neocortex is now offline. There's no point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I feel like for high conflict couples specifically, that's actually a really good tool, because there's usually like an audible sound or some sort of a chime or something that, they don't have to call a timeout. It's like when you hear that sound, there is a timeout, right? So even if you're not using an oximeter, you can create rules. Like if someone calls someone a name, that's like an automatic timeout. Or if someone, there's certain things that can indicate, like you don't have to even have a discussion when that's happening. It's time to take a little break,
How do you keep people from freaking out?
you mean just in general, like as they're having the conversation,
like arguing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I talk about in my book is that like most body calming techniques that people use, you're not going to be able to access that in an argument if you never do it otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like you can't drop into your breath in a really horrible argument if you've never done that as a regular practice. And so some of the things about managing your own body, it's like developing practices that you do on a regular basis so that you're so familiar with being able to calm yourself down that when it happens in an argument and you need to calm yourself down, you can quickly kind of go to that place, mm-hmm. And so you know, there's different techniques for whether or not you're doing it in the middle of an argument or whether you're doing it like in a timeout. So in the middle of an argument, things like breathing and pausing and things like that can really work, or even like tapping left and right on your legs or snapping your fingers, you know, something bilateral. But if you're taking a break and you need to calm down, you can, you know, take a cold. You can, so I have clients that like to clean when they take a timeout because cleaning calms them down. I don't really understand that, but hey, whatever works for you. You know, walk around the block, get some fresh air, you know, sing a song you love, whatever it is that can kind of calm down your physiology.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, the big sort of catch 22 in all of that is to follow any rules. You have to be not freaked out enough to remember to follow the rules or to be motivated to follow the rules. So a lot of it is about practicing beforehand so that you don't tend to get to that point.
Yes, exactly. That
point is sort of, you know, your amygdala is firing like crazy and it's going to be a little while. Well, you know, Jill Bolte Taylor's stuff. She's the one, she had My Stroke of Insight. That was her.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She talks about that when she was without her left hemisphere for a long time, you know, having had a stroke, she didn't have the capability of getting mad the way she did when she got it back. That's left hemisphere stuff mostly. Left hemisphere amygdala. And she said she discovered it's about 90 seconds, about a minute and a half. When you start freaking out, if you don't keep reciting how pissed off you are, then you'll probably calm down in about a minute and a half. So telling people that is helpful because it gives them a little bit of perspective. It's like, it's only a minute and a half. We don't have to even go to separate rooms. If we can wait a minute and a half, chances are we'll be able to carry on.
Right. It's just about buying yourself some time, you know? Yeah. I also like to have my clients write down, maybe on a little laminated sheet or whatever, what their calming techniques are for themselves. Because like you're saying, once you get into that place, you can't remember all the things you were going to do to calm yourself down. But if you kind of have it written down, you're like, okay, when I feel this, I'm going to follow this list. You know, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do this and then I'll do that. And sometimes that helps people who kind of lose contact with that part of their brain once they hit a certain point to have it written down. Yeah.
The thing about conflicts is interesting. When I saw your material, I was thinking about, there's a famous Talmudic dictum that says argument for the sake of heaven will endure. An argument not for the sake of heaven will not endure. Now, what are they mean?
I love that.
Yeah. They're saying that basically there are some arguments that are worth having for their own sake. They're good arguments. It's like, this is a good thing to contend on. Uh-huh. And you know, the Talmud is full of arguments. It records all of the different arguments because it gives them all respect.
Yes.
There are the arguments they're saying, no, this one just is not helping anybody. And how do you help a couple distinguish between those?
Yeah, it's funny. I have a whole section in my book called Should You Argue? You know, and it's dicey because you don't want to give the conflict avoiders another excuse not to argue. You know, they're like, oh, great, I don't have to argue, you know, and really the motivation behind that is they just don't want to have a conflict. But you're absolutely correct that there are some things that, you know, people are arguing over that just, you know, as you guys are married, it's like, sometimes you just need to let stuff go, you know? Yeah. And so I think kind of where I'm at is this a theme or is someone just having a bad day? You know? So it's kind of like, we all have bad days, and having some mercy towards each other or forgiveness toward each other for like small things is a beautiful, you know, quality to have. So, you know, I tell people sometimes, you know, if my husband does something one time and it annoys me, I'm like, okay, maybe he's just having a bad day. But then if I notice it a second time and I'm annoyed again, I think, okay, this is maybe now developing into a theme, you know? And so, but then if we are having that conflict, we're having the conflict about the theme, not about the dish on the sink or whatever the irritant is. So it's kind of, sometimes it does take a little bit of skill and practice to determine, is this something that I should, you know, just be gentle with my partner about and let go? Or is this a theme that is really going to turn into a resentment or a larger issue? And then we should be talking about it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that ability, or it's not even an ability, but that condition that would let someone incline toward mercy, you know, incline toward goodwill,
Yeah.
That's, you know, the metaphor of the emotional bank account, you know, it's like you need a nice big store of goodwill in there. And then a lot of those little annoyances don't even rise to the level of annoyances if there's lots of goodwill. It's like, well, of course you never annoy me, but I annoy Judy constantly and she's wonderful about it, I have to say. She,
Certainly
more than you annoy me, which is like never.
Well, that's true.
And but look, I'm being slightly silly, but that silliness is based in that notion of goodwill. That I don't see stuff as annoyances because I so appreciate you, you know? And when a couple has that store of goodwill, then still there will still be differences that have to be worked out, but they won't even necessarily be annoyances. They'll just be differences.
Yeah. And it's a great point because actually making those deposits, making emotional deposits and positivity in your relationship is actually part of your conflict management plan, you know? So it's kind of like when people hear like healthy conflict, they're only thinking about the argument part, but actually part of the whole totality of having healthy conflict in your relationship is a lot of deposits, a lot of good stuff happening. Because to your point, if you have tons of good stuff going on, you're not going to have as many conflicts, period. And
the book I'm working on now, actually, the working title is Betrayal, Faith, and Forgiveness. And the reason I note betrayal in this context is I've worked with folks where the story, they're so overdrawn in that account that a simple oversight is perceived not merely as an annoyance, but as a betrayal. And I've heard people use that word. Oh my God, he forgot that again. He's betrayed me. He lied to me that he would do it. Well, he didn't lie. He just forgot.
Yeah.
And that's what they would have thought had there been a store of goodwill going on. If said, well, that was annoying that you forgot. And, you know, the guy would have said, like I so often say, sorry, I forgot. I mean, you know, it's like, it's not like an indictment of anybody's character. It's like, oh, geez, that's annoying. I'm sorry. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't cause any problems. It's like, it's just what it is. But when there's that over, you know, that overdraw, there's lots of penalties to be paid, and that anything turns into a huge problem.
Absolutely. And yeah, I feel like couples come in thinking, well, we used to have good communication and now we don't. And I always say like, no, you used to have $1 million in the bank and now you don't, you know, it's not, your communication really probably hasn't changed all that much. It's just, you used to, you know, have a lot more going in the positive sense.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a difference between healthy and unhealthy conflict?
Yes, I think, I mean, like we've been discussing, I think unhealthy conflict usually happens when you're already mad. And because you're already mad, you're physiologically overstimulated. And then you're going to use kind of the cognitive errors that you would hear about in CBT. You're going to start labeling each other. You're going to start thinking in black and white terms. You're going to discount the positive and think only about the negative. You're going to, if you're really far along, you're going to call each other names and say, you always do this or you never do this, you know? So it's kind of like a lot of damage gets done in an unhealthy conflict. That's just not necessary. If you learn to have a healthy conflict, you can have the same conversation without the hurtful parts, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know Ian Leslie's book on conflict that came out a year or two ago?
No.
I don't know much about his work. He's a more of a journalist. He's not a therapist or anything.
Oh, okay.
And the book itself was written, I think, especially for the business market. But I really enjoyed it. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. What he wrote about was how necessary conflict is in all kinds of relationships. Mentioned couples, but he was also talking about, you know, therapists with difficult clients, and he was talking about the correction system, and he was talking about law enforcement officers interviewing people who do not want to give them information that they want to get, like interviewing a terrorist suspect and things like that. So it was fascinating. One of the things I really enjoyed, I think it's why I quoted him, my most recently published book is called It's Not About Communication. You're good at communicating. The problem is what you're communicating, you know, that he points out that whatever rules you have, and they're all like all the rules we've been talking about, they're good rules, you know, whatever rules you have, it's trumped essentially by being genuine. And he gave this great example of a guy in a sergeant in a police, you know, setting. And this one guy who was his superior officer was describing this particular sergeant. And he's saying, and the guy who was telling the story was all about ways of de-escalating. You know, he's all the rules for ways of de-escalating. So he told this one story of this guy. He said, so I'm the guy telling the story. I'm sitting there with this young man who's done a suicidal gesture and trying to convince him, you know, gently, but, you know, compassionately to come to the hospital. The sergeant comes in and says, look, what do you want to do? You want us to, we haven't got time for this. Do you want to come with us or not? You know, and the guy, the kid goes, so the guy telling the story is thinking, oh no, he's blown it. The kid goes with him. And what the guy telling the story was, and that's what always happens with this guy. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't saying all his rules are bad rules. Mm-hmm. He was saying it depends on the person. And there's something about it, because there was something in this gruff guy's affect that mm-hmm. was projecting genuine care.
Yeah.
He wasn't taking any shit, but he was projecting uh-huh. genuine care.
And right.
People would pick that up. Mm-hmm. And so there's something yeah. about that that's sort of, you know, whatever procedures we have, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. what you're showing, well, maybe it's related to that store of goodwill, you know, if you're showing genuine compassion and genuine openness, mm-hmm. even if you're being
gruff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, partners, Jen, and when we're talking about couples, you know your partner's personality. So it's like, you know if they're being genuine or not being genuine in that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Certainly. And that, of course, that comes up in the domain of sex when we talk about, you know, with sex. Uh-huh. The idea, the couples that strive for all the great rules of communication so that they can be really careful about how they talk to each other, they do great, except in the area of sex, where it tends to be really boring. The couples that are willing to, again, it's a tricky balance because they're not uh-huh. talking about being jerks, but the couples that are willing to be who they are in those uh-huh. moments, even if it's not exactly politically correct, tend to uh-huh. have a lot livelier sex lives.
Yeah. So then I was going to tell you guys too about the third step in the conflict is also it's the problem solving conversation, nice. You know? And I think, so what I do with my couples is after they've had this conversation where they fully understand each other, I want them to come to the problem solving conversation with at least 5 potential solutions. So they each come with at least, because you know what it is normally is there's my solution and your solution. I want them, now that they understand each other, to come up with at least 5. And so they can be from the ridiculous to the, you know, I give this example in my book, like if your problem is laundry, like I can do the laundry, you can do the laundry, we can pay someone to do the laundry, we can throw away our clothes when they get dirty, you know what I mean? Like just like a bunch of different potential solutions. And then
they each too. Don't forget the elves.
Right, exactly. That's who I want to do my laundry. Yeah. And then, you know, they each get 1 veto if they have at least 5. So 1 that they're just not even going to discuss. And then they just talk through each potential solution. What would that be like? What would the downside be? You know, how would I feel? How would you feel? And so just having a nice, you know, kind of back and forth about each and every solution. And then sometimes a solution just naturally emerges, or sometimes it comes down to like, okay, we kind of like these 2. Let's pick this one. Let's do it for 2 weeks. And then let's have this discussion mm-hmm. again, see how it went. And if it wasn't perfect, we'll try the second one, okay. You know? So just kind of like, but that conversation is usually pretty fun, but as long as you come with more than just 2 solutions, because then you're just back to the original argument.
That's a great idea. It's interesting. Yeah. Expand and including the ridiculous is a great idea, I think,
yeah.
just because it lightens the whole thing. You're describing, of course, 2 people having a conversation who are not freaking out, uh-huh. who have goodwill toward each other, who want yes. what they want, but also acknowledge that there's validity in what the other person wants. Uh-huh. That's what it looks like. And then you don't need rules for how they can communicate. They're going to be fine.
Yeah. You know,
they'll do what they
but
do.
But you have to get them there.
You have to get them there. Yes, that's steps 1 and 2. You have to get them there. Yeah. Then, of course, there are those conflicts where the solution is to realize, oh my God, there isn't a good solution here.
Uh-huh. Correct.
Can you address some of that?
Yeah. So like, you know, if I want to have a baby and you don't, or I want to move to Oklahoma and you don't, I mean, someone is going to get 100% of their way in a solution to those problems. You know, there isn't such a thing as a compromise. Yep. And so again, I feel like the process still works in those situations, in the sense of if you're having that conversation in a calm space, and you've had the conversation where you really and truly understand each other, then you're going to be able to sit down and say, okay, there may be only two solutions here. But again, even that solution conflict has more options than you might think, right? So, okay, I'm willing to have a child, but we have to have a nanny, you know, or okay, I'm willing to move to Oklahoma as long as you take X amount of weeks off to be, you know, if, or we spend summers here or, you know, so I think you can still expand those conversations. And I think people get stuck in the black and white of it.
Yeah.
And even though there may not be a solution that's a true compromise for both people, I still think you can, if you go through the process and have enough goodwill, you can find ways that both people's, you know, the book, Getting to Yes.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So you can still find a solution that gets to, that meets people's needs, even if it doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
But you have to go through the process. Yeah.
Yes, of course. And, you know, it is interesting because with respect to the getting to yes thing, it comes up in this context too. There are folks, I mean, there are things that are simply deal breakers. In other words, there are situations where the solution is that we split up. And they're just
absolutely painful,
but sometimes that's what happens. And the getting to yes thing is interesting in that kind of context, because if they don't agree on that, then it's the sort of mediation approach that's embodied in the getting to yes idea. I'm spacing out on those authors' names.
Remember William Ury is one of them. Yes. I can't remember the other one. Yeah. But those are great books. Getting to Yes and Getting Past No. Yeah.
But they only work in a context where at least the parties agree that they want to agree. Because then there are situations where you don't have that possibility.
Yeah.
It's just going to make something happen, even though the other one doesn't want, you know, people can file. I'm glad we live in a culture. And of course I'm old enough to remember you. I don't know. I'm 6 years older than Judy. I'm not sure this was true when in your memory or not, because the changes happened in the '70s before it was possible to get a divorce if your partner didn't agree to it, or if you didn't prove something horrible, you know, adultery or something like that, or violence or something like that. Now it is much more possible in any state to, if someone wants a divorce, they can get one. And so that sometimes, if they can't agree on what they're agreeing on, sometimes that's, which is painful.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of come from a space that if a couple's coming to me, I'm going to try to help them save their relationship. But I also understand that not every relationship can be saved or should be.
Yeah.
Right. But
yeah.
I do think that if you go through a process like this and learn healthy conflict, you can at least come apart in a much healthier way.
Yeah.
Than you would have if you weren't practicing the healthy conflict. I mean, I can acknowledge in a kind and loving way that the solution doesn't exist for us. And then, we could be such better co-parents or whatever, even if the ultimate solution is that it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Wow.
Alas. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you also do work with chronic illness and pain, and I'm curious, like, how did you get into that? And tell us.
Yes. About. Well, so after my second child was born, I had just really debilitating fatigue. And it took me about 10 years to get a diagnosis. And I now know that this is normal, unfortunately, with rare diseases.
But it takes that long to get a diagnosis. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the national average is like 4 doctors and 7 years if you have like an autoimmune disease or a rare disease. So it's unfortunately kind of a mess. But eventually I got diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disease. And so I just feel like the universe kind of works this way. All of a sudden, all these people started calling me who had chronic illness problems, you know? And because I was working through kind of a process on how to live with a chronic illness, I felt like I had something to offer them. And so eventually I kind of, you know, started advertising that I do this work. And then I took a training with Jackie Nix up in Canada. She does, you're familiar with the mindfulness-based stress reduction. She does mindfulness-based chronic pain management. So it's a MBSR type model for chronic pain management. So the main thing I do is just kind of, you know, when you argue with reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time, you know? And so it's kind of like accepting that there is no door number three where you're going to be well now. This is a chronic illness. It doesn't have a solution. So being fully in reality with how things are, how can you also create a life of meaning, a life that you value, a life that is meaningful to you, even if it's not the life you thought you were going to be living? Yeah.
That, and that is, that's a great way of describing what I call faith. That,
yes.
Is that very thing. What I say faith is when you accept that reality is right to be what it is. It's accepting it and then accepting it as meaningful. It's
yeah.
Like, okay, well, this sucks, but I can learn from it.
Yeah.
I can handle right. it well. You know, I can uh-huh. do the best I can with it. There's uh-huh. some meaning in that. It's, yeah. You know, Viktor Frankl wrote about, even in Auschwitz,
yeah.
you could find some way. You couldn't control mm-hmm. anything. You couldn't control the,
yeah.
the probability of dying.
Right. But you can control, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could control how you handled it and that mm-hmm. was meaningful. That there was yes. something meaningful and good about mm-hmm. handling that as well as you could, even if it wasn't very well.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's an important thing. And certainly mm-hmm. that would apply in any sort of chronic illness, I would imagine. And
yeah. 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 So I kind of say, you know, you can have chronic pain and lay around in your bed all day and do nothing, or chronic illness and lay around and do nothing, or you can have chronic pain and live a life of meaning, but you don't have an option to not have chronic pain.
Yeah.
So, you know, given that it is what it is, I, you know, work for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's well, tragic worse. It's kind of like grief work, you know, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, exactly. And that's, of course, that's universal. That we're all going to die, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about that you could take as sort of, oh, really?
I'm not just all going to die. Uh-huh. We're all going to have people in our lives that died too.
Right. We're all going to
yes.
lose people, and we're all going to cause loss.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that you could say, well, that's a real bummer. You could say, well, there's something beautiful about life uh-huh. then, given that it's
yes.
fine. Uh-huh. Kind of comes with it. It's not a bug; it's a feature. You know.
Yes.
That's how
yeah.
it works.
Yeah.
So you know, to be able to accept that is a great skill to learn.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So how can people reach you if they and mention your book again, which I don't think I had noticed it in your material, so otherwise it would have been in your intro. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's called Healthy Conflict, Happy Couple. The subtitle is How to Let Go of Blame and Grow Stronger Together. You can find it on Amazon. It's also published by New Harbinger. And so if you're a therapist and you join New Harbinger's, like, it's free to join their clinicians club, you can get their books 20% off. So you can find me at New Harbinger or Amazon, Healthy Conflict, Happy Couple. And then, as you guys said, I review books on Therapy Book Nook on Instagram. And I also have a therapist Instagram, which is Lisa Gray MFT.
Great.
Yeah. So.
Well, we will put that information in the notes for this episode. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
It has been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great.
Welcome back. We hope you enjoyed that interview with Lisa. And anything else that you want to put in there?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, that anybody who is watching this, who's made it through to this part of the interview, if you send me a email that says, I saw the second part, I saw the outro, the stuff after your interview with Lisa Gray, mm-hmm. I will actually do something meaningful. You can tell I haven't thought this through thoroughly. But I will send you...
What are we coming up with on the spot?
I'll tell you what, on the spot, I will send you a PDF of any one of my books.
Ooh.
I will even send you, if you ask for it, I will even send you a code for a free download of one of my audiobooks. That actually costs money, folks. Mm. I have a limited number of those to give.
Wow.
I will give you that if all you have to do is send an email to us. If you go to ctn7.com, you'll see there's a contact form there. Send an email saying, we heard the outro after your interview with Lisa Gray, and just say what it is you'd like. And I will probably be inclined to give it to you, because I'll just be so astonished that anybody actually is hearing this.
There
so,
you go.
Not at all astonished, by the way, that people are hearing much of our podcast, because our number's actually quite good. But this is a little test to see, is anybody actually still tuned in
yeah.
at the end here, you know? Because I'm not, when I listen to podcasts, I don't always hang on until the end.
Uh-huh. Oh, I do.
Do you? Well, good. So for those of you who are like the want to make sure to get every little bit of your money's worth in the podcast, here you are. There you go. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.